I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
I'm going back a third time. Not the same role, different roles. Mm-hmm. And the reader comes out. You know, she's calling people into the room. And she's like, oh, she comes out. Oh, hey, Nelson. So, so I guess... So-and-so, the casting director, has said, like, so, I guess some people have been coming in the room and, like, winking at her. And I'm like, oh, weird, like, winking at her? She's like, yeah. And she says it kind of disturbs her. I'm like, oh, my God, that's weird. I'm like, I'm not one of those people, right? She's like, no, you are. And I'm like,
what?
I'm like, yeah, like, you're winking at her. And then I'm, like, in my head, I'm going, oh, I think I have this, like, nervous tic at the time where I'm just going kind of like at the end of a sentence or like walking out of a room. I'm like, okay, I'll see you later. Bye. You know, I'm just kind of like, all right, see you later. And then I'm like, oh my God, like she thinks it's some, like, I don't know what she thinks it is, but it's just, I do it to guys. I do it to girls. I do it to babies. I do it to grandmas. Like, it's not that's nothing about coming on to anybody. Just like more of, it's some tic that I developed, right?
Hello, world, and welcome back to another episode of Thanks for Coming In. I'm your host, Jillian Clare. If you're not subscribed to the show, make sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening and check out the show notes to see the exclusive videos from these interviews on our Patreon. What's up? So I am recording this in advance a little bit. We recorded the interview like 2 weeks ago, and now I'm recording this a week before you're hearing it. Which makes it very funny because today's episode features a fantastic actor who was in episode 8 of The Last of Us. So when we recorded the interview, I hadn't seen episode 8. I have now seen episode 8, but now that you're listening to it, you've seen episode 9 and I haven't. Sounds complicated, I know. Anyway, we didn't give away any spoilers because I was like, please don't tell me what happens because I'm such a big fan. So there's that. So let's get to it. Today we have Nelson Lee. You may remember him as Beelzebub in The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. He's been in the movie Prey, Story of a Girl with Kira Sedgwick, that she directed it. Amazing. He has his own web series called The Gym that he wrote and produced. And funny enough, throughout the episode, we actually find out that we are probably in the same place at the same time. Very strange. What a small world. And yes, most recently, he was in The Last of Us as Josiah, aka the dude that gets it in the basement. You know what I'm talking about. So here is my conversation with Nelson. And welcome to the show, Nelson.
Thanks for having me, Jillian. Happy to be here. Excited.
Me too. I'm so excited to talk to you. We have so many awesome things to talk about that you have been in and are currently in. But before we get to any of that, the first thing that I always like to ask all of my guests is, what made you want to be an actor?
Ooh, wow. That's the big question.
Yeah.
That takes 3 hours to answer, but let's see.
We hit with the hard facts first.
Yeah. So I guess in one way I was exposed to it, but not sort of like, you know, my parents weren't actors. Well, my mom wanted to be an actor is the short question or the short answer, but, you know, sort of came from this European background, very sort of dogmatic overlord father, where that was like not a thing to do or pursue. But when she came, my mother is French, she's from Nice, and she did study acting and dance. And I was in a short film when I was 4 years old, and she never went down that road. She became an interviewer and eventually worked for the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Yeah, so I was around media, not necessarily film and television, but she was producing French news. She was working at the CBC, and I would go there every day after school, grades 3, 4, 5, 6. And it was like this big studio, these big cavernous halls with these giant coils of cable that looked like snakes, and those cameras from the 1980s that were like
massive
robots, massive, you know, that slid across the floor, studio cameras. And I think a seminal moment was I met Michael J. Fox there. It was pretty amazing. He used to do these holiday Christmas specials, which I don't even think they do them anymore, but you can imagine those holiday specials from the 1980s and 1990s, yeah. Probably even 1970s. And he came and hosted one. And at that point, he was probably at the height of his fame. Family Ties, Back to the Future.
The best.
And I met him there, and it solidified that, like, oh, wow, like that person on TV is here in the flesh, and like, this is a real thing that you can do. Wow. So that set me on my path. Yeah.
That's amazing. How old were you when you met him?
I think I was 10 or 11.
Wow.
Yeah. And I have a photo. I should have dug it out. Of the two of us in this old Canadian studio, and we both have like 1980s bowl cuts. It's very funny. Like, he was, you know, a star, and there he is. But I guess it was cool at the time, right? And he's got his Michael J. Fox kind of jaggedy bowl cut. I've got the same look. It was totally awesome. Yeah, my little sister's there, and I remember my mom was trying to take photos of us, and her camera was malfunctioning, and she was a little nervous. So he took it, and he fixed it, and we got the photo. Yeah.
Wow.
He fixed my mother's camera. I think it's on my Instagram way back in my feed somewhere. I think I posted it one time.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow. So you meet Michael J. Fox, and then you're like, dang, this is it. I know I can do this now.
And then the next day, you know, I was off to a career and making, no, not at all. There's a lot of in between. So on my father's side, my parents were divorced at that point. He's and still is an entrepreneur and a businessman. He had his fingers in a lot of things, and he dabbled very briefly in the film industry. Sort of as an executive producer type. And so, you know, when you all of a sudden put yourself in some directories, like a producer, an executive producer, and you just start receiving all these scripts and these posters from people who are sending things unsolicited. So it was really neat to me. There were these trauma film type posters that were arriving at our office, like the Toxic Avenger stuff from the AFM. And so there I am, this young kid, maybe I'm 12 at that point. There's these, you know, just really crazy, cool posters arriving in the mail. And so, you know, he didn't go into it much further than, like, I think he, you know, executive produced like an indie film.
Yeah.
And he went with his other businesses after that.
He's like, we got to figure out something that sustains money better.
Yeah. Yeah. So he stayed with the mining business, mining and real estate development. He did a lot of things.
Smart.
That's another story.
That's smart.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. But you moved around a lot as a kid from what I read. You guys were in Texas. You moved back to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you were after high school, you went to college in New York.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I'm Canadian. I was born in Ontario. We went to Texas for a short time and then more or less raised in Vancouver, BC, in the suburbs. And then New York. Yeah. So, but a lot of American influence in that my dad had mining contracts down there. So we were in Arizona and Nevada a lot.
Wow.
We'd go to California on vacation. So, you know, America really like held this allure. It was this magical place where everything was possible. I mean, not that things aren't possible in Canada, but especially when we went to Los Angeles, that was the epicenter of entertainment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like, you know, my everything was just bubbling for me. Like the crack in the sidewalk was so mysterious and exciting to me in Los Angeles. Like, oh my gosh, look at Runyon Canyon and look at these. I was like Dorothy, you know, like transported from Kansas. It was, yeah. So America and Los Angeles and California from a young age took on an allure for me. Mm. Yeah.
So is that what made you go to New York for college, or were you just like, that's where the scene is and that's where I need to be?
Yeah, eventually. So I started studying acting in a, you know, serious way, going to scene study class in about 1992, 93. I'm throwing my age out there now, man. He is an old guy, that Nelson Lees. And then, you know, even back then, Vancouver had already become a film epicenter, TV, specifically a TV epicenter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there were barely any places to study, scene study back then. So I was at this place called the Gastown Actor Studio. It was kind of like anybody who went on to like be somebody who either sustained a career in Canada or moved to the U.S., they studied there at the time if they were of that vintage. And I remember a guy came back and he was studying in my class and he had done a summer class in New York at the American Academy. And I didn't even put it together that was a thing that you could do. It sounds silly, but like, oh wait, I can go to New York City and study at like a theater school? This is amazing. There was no internet at the time, so you had to go to the library, you had to get the pamphlets,
right?
Like the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, you know.
Literally,
you
right apply. When you said that, I thought like, yeah, of course you wouldn't know because there's not Instagram ads popping up and like just in your face all the time saying, hey, come do this, come do that.
Totally.
It was like something that's, you know, you wouldn't think of doing that.
Absolutely. And I already had a taste for the movies that I liked, and a lot of them were like New York centric stories and Martin Scorsese films, and so immediately when I got accepted in the American Academy, you could go to New York or Los Angeles, and I was like, I've got to go to New York. That's Mecca for me, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Dustin Hoffman and all the guys that I was watching at the time, Robert De Niro and all those guys, Harvey Keitel, right? They were from there, so I'm like, that's where I got to go. That's calling me. And it truly lived up to what I thought it was. I'm from this suburb called White Rock, which is this small little town, which is, you know, it's very white. And so I go to New York City and it just, everything that I saw in the movies was actualized. Like the smell, that metallic smell of the subway. And there's like, what? You can buy a bagel with cream cheese on the street and you can buy bananas on the street from a vendor? This is amazing. Like everything was just like, this is the best place on earth.
Mm.
Yeah.
I get it. I mean, I've gone to New York a lot almost once a year since I was a child. And every time I go, I'm just like, why am I ever leaving? This place is great. And then I get home to my nice big backyard and I say, this is why. I understand.
Yeah. Absolutely. I get that.
So you go to college and then what happens after that? Do you stay there for a while and try to work things out? Do you go back to Vancouver?
I stay there for a little bit. But I'm running out of money at that point. So I go back to Vancouver, and I immediately got into like a touring production. I'm sure they have something similar where you are, you know, those shows that travel to high schools, and they're sort of like shows for kids, but they're kind of education based. There's like, you know, it's either about, drugs, you know, or in this case, it was a pretty serious, absolutely serious subject. It was about child prostitution, teen prostitution.
Oh my goodness.
The word human trafficking didn't really exist at the time. I mean, maybe it existed, but it wasn't used as readily as it is today. And so of course I got cast as a pimp. That was the beginning of that was the early days of my typecasting. That was I should have known when that happened. I'm like, okay, we're on the track for the rest of my career.
Yeah, that's it. That's all you're doing.
And so we had a number of companies like that in Canada where you go and you're talking about, I guess you'd call them social issues, right? Educating kids through skits and role playing. And so I got, we wrote this show. We had to write a monologue to get cast in it. I got cast. Then we wrote the show from scratch. And then we toured all over British Columbia.
Wow.
And it was pretty powerful. We were the first cast, and it's still running like 30 years later.
Wow.
Yeah, they've tweaked it, of course, over the years, but you know, it was pretty cool to be involved with that, you know. It was the first of its kind and a very powerful project, and the woman who started it, who initiated it, her daughter ended up on the street, and that's why she started this with the provincial government.
It's always something with something that's so, you know, impactful like that. It usually comes from a place of knowing. So that makes so much sense that her daughter struggled that way.
Yeah. So I, that was a really cool thing to be a part of and to have written, and then to be acting essentially every day. We're going to high schools and elementary schools, every single day talking about this, traveling around. And then, I mean, we're talking about a big time period after theater school and leading up to the 2000s, but I kind of lost my way a little bit for a few years. I did that. That ended and my agent dropped me. And I think this is like 1996. And I, you know, I was young. I guess at that point I'm 22 years old. But even though I'd gone to theater school, I'm still figuring out what is my craft? Who am I as an actor? What does this even mean? You know, I think that it takes a while for everybody. And so I went and worked with my father's company, and I renounced acting for close to 3 years.
Wow.
Never to act again. And I, you know, regretfully got rid of these theater books and some of these,
because
I'm like, if I, you know, because people would say, well, you know, get a side job or this and that. Like I knew even at that time, I didn't know a lot, but what I did know is the amount of dedication that's required. And I'm like, nope, if I'm out, I am out. I'm fully out, you know?
Wow.
If I'm in, I'm fully in. So I'm like, nope, I'm done acting. I got rid of my theater books, all these Sam Shepard playbooks. Oh, man. And, but then, you know, it's like the mafia, I guess, after they never let you go, right? And after two and a half, 3 years, I started dating somebody, and she's like, oh yeah, no, I'm an actor and I'm studying with this woman, Ivana Chubbuck. I'm like, Ivana Chubbuck?
I love Ivana Chubbuck.
Oh wow, she's got a school in Vancouver, and I was going to study with her before I left acting. And it just pulled me back. And that was the little breadcrumb moment. So I started following the trail. And then I said to myself when I got back in around 99, 2000, if I get back into this, I'm going to be good to myself. I'm going to be kind to myself as an actor, because I was so hard on myself as a young actor. You know, just all the criticisms that we all have, but our work and, you know, back then we're so vain. I mean, it was literally like, oh my, the way I look on camera and I'm horrible, my teeth and my nose and my whatever, right? I mean, it's silly, but it's real.
Yeah.
And so I said, if I get back into this thing, I'm going to be good to myself. I'm going to trust the process. I'm going to lean into the process. I'm going to lean into studying. And I never looked back. That was like, you know, mid 99. And wow, here I am now. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I've talked to a lot of people on the show, and they're either before that, like 23, 24, 25 point where you're like, what am I doing with my life? The, you know, the quarter life crisis moment, or they're past it. And, you know, I totally relate to it, because there's that moment when you're mid 20s where you're just like, what am I doing? I haven't made it. All of these people, look at all these people. They're doing this. They're making it. And they're already there. They're already where I want to be. I'm too old now.
Totally.
And it's such an industry specific thing too, because they're constantly trying to get the younger person, the hotter person, whatever it is. And so it gets into your head, especially in your 20s, where you're just like, well, I haven't made it yet, so I don't think I will.
Yeah.
But I always tell people, like, if you can just make it past like 30 and stick with it, then the doors open wide open.
And I just had to, I totally agree with all that. That is the toughest part of this business, is the stick with itness factor.
Yeah.
Like, sure, the craft is its own thing, and that grows and evolves. And it should, you know, how you integrate with the work at 20 will be different than 45, because you've experienced probably some loss and some disappointment. And so that infuses itself into the work.
And you've worked with so many more people. And when you work with other actors, then how you act changes too. And it evolves 100%. Over time.
I needed to grow up. And, you know, the older I've gotten, actually, the better it's been. Like, literally, the older looking I get, the better it's been for, you know, this old character-y face here.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a DP tell me, I think I'm like 33 or 34 at the time, and we're having lunch. And he looks at faces every day. That's what he does for a living. And he's like, you'll work in your 40s. And I was so upset. I was, you know, I'm 33 and I'm like, I'm working now. Like, I worked like a year ago, you know, and I was, you know, you don't want to hear that when you're 33, like you're going to work in your 40s. But the bastard was right. I just aged. I got more interesting looking. I got more mature. I just settled into myself.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of actors, too, that, like, you know, I always look at people like Allison Janney and Sarah Paulson, who were working for a long time, mm-hmm. but didn't start having the nitty-gritty roles, the things that really made them thrive as actors until, you know, their 40s, 50s, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, and we're, you know, we're in a great place now. I mean, you can speak to this, but I think for women now, like, that wasn't the case 30 years ago. We're like, when you hit 50 as a woman and you hit 55, you're going to be playing awesome roles. Like, in 1985, it was like, no, you were done at 35. But now you could probably say
your grandma. It's like, who is it? Betty White and all the Golden Girls people. They were like in their 50s and 60s looking like they were 90. And everyone was like, what is happening? How is this possible?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
you know, I was going to say that the people that, you know, we talk to our peers about, like, their experiences, and you glean what you can. Obviously, you can never fully compare because we all have our own journeys. But a lot of the people, and of course, Canadians speak to Canadians because it's so unique kind of what we do here. We're sort of a service industry. Some of us go to Los Angeles. Some of us go back and forth. But so you talk to a lot of your Canadian peers, and a lot of the people that I speak to are actually who are older than me. Are women, and they're freaking killing it, man. Like my friends who are mostly have stayed here, and they're like 55, 60, 65. They're killing it, man.
Yeah.
They're doing fantastic. Yeah. So it's
stick it out is the moral of the story. Yeah. Stick it out.
Stick it out. 100%.
We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out the Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find the Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
And back to the show. Before we talk about The Last of Us, which I definitely need to get to, I first want to talk to you a little bit about Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and what it was like transforming into Beelzebub all the time. I can't even imagine how long that took.
I think it was two and a half hours the first time. And then because I always work with the same prosthetic team, they really got it down. At one point, it was down to like an hour and a quarter.
Wow.
And it was really cool. You know, I mean, putting on that skin just literally helped you transform as an actor. And then I did a lot with my body. I did a lot with my voice. And that gave me the confidence also to just to fully transform. So it was a real gift. It really was. Yeah.
I mean, there's no like precedent for playing a demon. You can do whatever you want. So it must have been really cool to like you said, mess with your body and your movements and try to figure out like what this mystical creature would be doing.
Absolutely. And I took a big risk with the voice too, because in the audition, I was not doing anything to my voice. I was more or less speaking like this. And then I thought, there's got to be something there. So I leaned into this gravel and I, you know, started working with it, working with my recorder on my phone and then working in the mirror. And I thought, I don't know, this is like, you know, it wasn't big, you know, because it justified it, but it certainly was not a thing that they hinted at or asked for. I'm like, I'm going to walk on set. I'm going to do this voice. And I'm cool if they say, whoa, just drop that and just talk like you. But I'm like, I need to take the big swing. And you know what that's like as an actor. You're walking onto a show. It's not your show. You're not at that point recurring. You're at that point like a day player doing one episode.
Wow.
And you know what it's like. You make some choice and you walk up to the star. And like, you got to bring your shit, man, and not worry and just take a big swing and be like, okay, I'm gonna hold space here and go with this decision. And it worked out. It worked out.
I love that. I love what you just said. I'm gonna hold space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, I mean, what we do when you're starting out and maybe for many years you're working with, you know, these people who we call stars or movie stars, right? But you have to hold as much space as they do, you know, like whether it's working with Pedro Pascal or the other people I worked with, like, because, you know, and especially if you're in a dominant position in the scene, like you can't shrink in front of these people, even though they might've been acting 40 more years than you, or they're so-called movie stars, right? You got to bring your game and kick their ass if that's what it calls for.
Their ass. Okay. Let's go to Last of Us then. Cause I want to know, the episode has aired at this point. We were recording this prior to it airing, so I don't know what's happened yet. But everybody who's listening probably knows what's happened. So first off, you're playing somebody named Josiah, which a lot of people online for a while speculated was David.
Right. I can say I am not David.
Yeah. Right. So this is a new character. What can you tell us about it without spoiling it for, you know, people who haven't seen it yet?
I can say that I am part of that group, that collective that David leads, and we know who David is from the game. And you know, we all, well, like everybody in The Last of Us, find ourselves in this really dire situation, but our group specifically is you know, on their sort of last leg of resources, and so we're doing whatever it takes to survive and barely surviving.
What was it? Because I played the video game and I'm actually replaying it right now just because the show has inspired me to replay it. What was it like to be in that world? Was there a sense of pressure of making sure it was as good as the game, or how was that environment?
You know, I think what was actually a benefit to me was I had not played the game. I'm not a gamer. So, I mean, I think I had heard. Yeah, obviously when I booked it, they're like, oh, this is based on this huge video game that's like the biggest in the world. And for me, that helped. And you know, the crazy thing is I didn't even know who Craig Mazin was at the time. I know, right?
Silly. You're killing me.
I know. So stupid. but not. It was like I knew about
Chernobyl,
but I hadn't watched it yet. And a friend of mine who's a writer, she's like, "Do you listen to this podcast, the one that he does?" And I'm like, "No." She's like, "Oh my god, you gotta listen to this because I'm a writer as well." And the reason I say it was beneficial was because I think if I walked on knowing who he was, I probably would have just been more like, you know, trying to get something from him. I just showed up and I did my job, and I knew he was the showrunner, obviously, but I didn't endow him with this like this great sort of like, "Oh my god, it's Craig Mazin, and oh, maybe if I talk to him a lot I can make an impression, and maybe I can get on his next show, and maybe he'll give me," you know, like I just went on and I did my job. And you know, I didn't know who Troy Baker was. Obviously Pedro Pascal, I was familiar with him.
Mm-hmm.
But the world was epic. The world was awesome. So just like game aside, me knowing nothing about the game, walking into this world, I mean, the budget, the world, the set deck. I mean, we took over an entire neighborhood in Calgary.
Wow. Like
just, they put all these people up in hotels and they were just gone. And we were playing in the sandbox of a neighborhood. It was so cool. Like, you know, you do jobs where, you know, now, you know, my story, it's kind of like 30-ish years long.
Yeah.
And I'm it's like it was day one. I'm like, "Oh my god, like this is so cool, man." Mm-hmm. I'm just like, I'm in the game, I'm in the movie. This whole neighborhood is the movie. It was fantastic. Nothing
that's
I'd ever
so
done
cool.
Like, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Did you have any interactions with the infected, clickers, anything like that?
I did not have any interactions with them. And I try to put this in a way that doesn't spoil anything.
Did you see them in real life?
I did not see them in real life. Okay. I had some physical difficulties in other ways in my episode.
Ooh.
I kind of have like a few jobs that I rank as like the most physically difficult of my career. And that was two jobs that I did back to back. Shogun and Last of Us were just like, I put my whole body into these roles, and you know, it's man, I left that set like battered. And not because people were doing their job, like it was safe to the nth degree, but just because how much I was running and putting into it, and just it was like I put my body through the ringer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
How was it working with Pedro and Bella? I mean, their chemistry on screen is just insane, and it's so fun to watch them, and they really do feel like they are the characters.
Yeah, they're like, you know, you've heard in all the interviews, like they're so cool, they're so lovely. You know, I'm staking that flag as well. Like Pedro is you know, my first day was with him, and he's just such a cool guy. He's so lovely. He's playful. He's funny. We had some like colleagues in common, so we talked about that. There was a shorthand immediately, you know. And I met him at the end of a long day for him, and I was just getting going. So you know, his body had been through the ringer. It was, I don't know what hour it was for him, maybe hour 10, and he was a trooper, man, and he was still light on his feet and giving it, and just like a pleasure to be around. Yeah, so nice, so cool, so fun.
Awesome. I can't wait to see. Well, on the show we like to share audition stories. Those can be upsetting or embarrassing, or the ones that got away. Are there any that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Oh man, so many. Right, you're an actor, you've had crappy auditions and stories that go along with them. Okay, I'll start with a good one.
Okay.
The first TV job that I ever booked. There was a Canadian sitcom called Big Sound about an agency for music artists. And there was this director who was very famous in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even 2000s, David Steinberg. He directed like Mad About You and Friends and all the big sitcoms at that time. And so the audition was for him. And it was one of those rare auditions that we can count on one hand where you're going in the room with other people. And so they pair us up. There's three of us and we're playing brothers of an Irish rock band.
Wow.
So I guess they want to see our chemistry. And so they, okay, Nelson, you and you, you're together. And we're like, and I'm like, hey, let's go outside and rehearse and just play with this over and over and over. And so we go outside and we're just messing around. And I said, now let's do it kind of like, let's just like explore the edges of this. Let's play it antagonistically now and just like get really physical and maybe just push each other on every line, like physically push each other after we say every line. So we're doing that and it feels good. And we really get in our bodies and we get an energy going. And then we go up into the room, we get called in. And then, oh, this is Mr. Steinberg. And he's like, just do what you guys were doing outside. And I'm like, oh my God, he was watching us outside. This is, so, you know, at that point, I think we probably already had the job because we were doing it unencumbered outside and just loosely, improvisationally adding lines. Yeah. And he loved that. So we probably already had the job by the time we walked in and we did it again. I think they gave us some notes. And that was my first TV job that I ever booked. I'd booked some commercials, but that was the first time on a scripted television show.
That's amazing. I love that he saw you and was like, wow, they took initiative. This is great. I like this.
Because I probably would have been just like, I mean, who knows? Maybe I would have booked it anyway, but I would have been like, you know, that was very early on when I came back into acting, a nervous actor just trying to get the scene right or find my way. And he saw me where I didn't have that lens on, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was
the lens
really
of
cool.
I have to be good. I'm meeting this person. I need to go in. I need to. It's so intimidating if you are just getting back into it and you're not used to the rigmarole, if you will.
So that's a positive.
I love that
story. Worked out well. My first job, and so okay. Here's one that's so weird, and I guess I'll tell it. This is more like, when was this? I don't know, maybe 7 years ago. I'm auditioning for this series up here. It's an American series, and I've been in for it a couple times. I'm going back a third time. Not the same role, different roles. Mm-hmm. And the reader comes out. You know, she's calling people into the room. And she's like, oh, she comes out. Oh, hey, Nelson. So, I guess... So-and-so, the casting director, has said, like, so, I guess some people have been coming in the room and, like, winking at her. And I'm like, oh, weird, like, winking at her? She's like, yeah. And she says it kind of disturbs her. I'm like, oh, my God, that's weird. I'm like, I'm not one of those people, right? She's like, no, you are. And I'm like,
what?
I'm like, yeah, like, you're winking at her. And then I'm, like, in my head, I'm going, oh, I think I have this, like, nervous tic at the time where I'm just going kind of like at the end of a sentence or like walking out of the room, I'm like, okay, I'll see you later, bye, you know, just kind of like, all right, see you later. And then I'm like, oh my God, like she thinks it's some, like, I don't know what she thinks it is, but it's just, I do it to guys, I do it to girls, I do it to babies, I do it to grandmas, like it's not a, it's, that's nothing about coming on to anybody, just like more of, it's some tic that I developed, right? And so she says, okay, so just don't wink at her. And I'm like,
oh, gosh.
Okay, great. And I go in and I'm doing the scene and we're done. She's like, great. And the whole time I'm doing my audition, like with my reader, like kind of almost like this.
Yeah, like, wide eyed and just like, and then, I can't wink.
Yeah, I can't wink. And then whenever she gives me feedback, I'm looking at her like, okay, thank you. And she says, great, Nelson. And I swear to God, I'm like, okay, thank you. See you later. And I'm like, oh. I almost pooped my pants. I couldn't believe that I winked. It was so ingrained in me at that point to wink as some sort of mechanism to overcome nerves or something. And then I look at my friend who's the reader, and I just leave. And then, so.
That's
amazing. There's more to this. So I write this person on Instagram, or Facebook at the time. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. That's crazy. She's like, ha ha ha. I guess these things are ingrained in us. And I go home and I'm thinking about this experience. And, you know, this casting director, Ed, who was one of those very interesting casting directors, had been known to say some interesting, maybe intense notes to people in the room. You know, we've all heard of casting directors like that. And maybe over the line type things. And I'm thinking, like, that was kind of a really over the line thing to do, like moments before
I go into an audition and I'm like, you know, she's kind of like, she's done that thing before. I know she likes my work because she's sort of said it, but she's just, you know, I don't want to, she's just, she goes over the line sometimes. So I call my agent. I said, you know what? This is the thing that happened. And I thought it was like off base for her to do that. I'm like, you know what? I don't want to read for her anymore. And he's like, okay, I totally respect that. Totally. You don't have to read for her anymore. Like, yep. And then he calls the next day and he's like, so awkward situation. You've got a callback for this. And I'm like, oh man. And he's like, but don't worry, producers and director are in the room. I'm like, okay, I'll do it.
Right.
Like, of course I'm gonna do it. But I'm like, I don't want to be in the room alone with her. Mm-hmm. And I go and I do it and I book it and I do the job and it all goes well. But I do say to him, like, yeah, sure, I booked that job, but let's just stick to the plan of not reading for her right now. Okay. Yeah. So that was a very, very weird experience, but I took my power back.
Yeah, you did. You took your power back. You know, we all have developed nervous little tics and whatnot throughout the years. Yours was a wink.
Yeah. Now, in this day and age where, and it's a great thing, like a lot of improprieties and inappropriate behavior has been exposed and is like, you just don't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's a great thing. But this was not that, you know. I wasn't really like, hey, I'll see you at the, hotel, you know. Yeah. So that was.
That's amazing. I love that so much.
Yeah. The wink.
The wink. Most people don't even have to experience anything like that nowadays because they're not even in a room. Mm-hmm. It's just all over self-tape.
Yeah, there's no winking issues anymore.
Winking issues. I love those. Those are both fantastic stories. They were fantastic. What do you have next? Do you have anything else coming out other than The Last of Us? Are you working on anything, writing anything?
I've got Shogun coming out. That's an FX show. It's another just like massively epic production based on the James Clavell novels. Clavell from the 1970s. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's about feudal Japan in the year 1600. I mean, it's a giant book and it's on the scale of The Last of Us, like, you know, 10 episodes, multi millions of dollars per episode because, you know, it's 1600 Japan.
Right.
And it starts on like a Spanish galleon. And that's where, you know, and I'm not giving anything away because there are barely any Caucasian people in this. And the ones that are Spanish sailors who wash up on the shore of Japan in the year 1600.
Wow.
So that is coming out this year. And that is going to be pretty cool as well. I think the majority of it is in Japanese.
That's amazing.
Which is awesome. Yeah, no, it's like, it's a giant world as big as The Last of Us. It's super cool.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to see it. And you have your own production company and you have a theater company. Where do you find the time for it all?
Well, we have a baby now. That's our main production. And so, man, that just like, I was talking with my wife yesterday. When you have a baby, and your time is now split, you realize what is important to you. Like, you know, maybe before where you're like, oh, I like to go to the gym and stay fit. And I'm a writer and I'm working on this project. And I was going to class, scene study class, improv class. And then you're like, you realize like, oh, wow, these are the things that I really miss that I put aside. And so writing is a thing that I've made a priority in my life again. So I have to get up at like, you know, 6 or before 6 to get any writing done. And it's sort of like you pick and choose, right? What is the priority in that time beyond your child? Right. And so I'm writing a pilot right now based on a web series that I did like 12 years ago. Whoa, which
this is
reminds
the gym.
Me.
We haven't. Right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
so
we have an overlap.
A web series called Misbehave at the same time. And we both must have been at LA Web Fest in 2011, which is wild to me.
Yeah. That's so cool. And you know Brian Beacock from McCracken Live.
Wait, okay, so Brian and I played Cindy Lou Who in The Grinch back in 2002 at Universal, and that's when I first met him. And then we did Acting Dead together, which my mom produced.
Wow.
How do you know Brian?
So when we wrote The Jam, we went to the 2000, well, I think it was actually 12 WebFest,
okay.
LA WebFest. I met him there. And then out of those, all the people that were in that, nine shows and producers were selected to go to the inaugural Marseille WebFest. And right. We were one of those shows along with Brian. And so we all went to France like 6 months later, and it was awesome. It was like, it was the first time that I'm like, oh, I can take, you know, it was one of those seminal moments where like, I can take a thing in my head, put it on the page, bring it through to the end goal, the end zone, and like, and create my own work. And that really did change my life, that whole experience.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, web series back then were so cool too. So my mom and I created Misbehave, and she wrote it. And then I think I was 16 or 17 when we first started it, but it was such a strange time for web series because like nobody knew where to put them.
Yeah.
Nobody knew how to watch them. You couldn't really stream anything yet. So you were just like, what are these? And
yeah.
People would be like, what do you mean you want to do a show yourself and put it on the web? And we're like,
yeah.
Well, that's like what we're going to do. And everyone's like, I don't understand.
Yeah. You nailed it on the head. And it's Netflix didn't exist or in the format that it does now.
Yeah.
I think Hulu was just starting. There was Sony Crackle.
Crazy. Yeah. Crackle.
Yeah. And so everybody in the web series world, like your mom's name is Susan. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay, yeah. So I remember that name from like 14 years ago.
Oh my God.
Barrett or Bernhardt?
Bernhardt, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, because everybody in that who was doing that work in that space, like, oh, there's this person in Los Angeles and this person in New York and this person in Paris. Like, everybody knew each other. And we were all ahead of our time.
So true. So true. Go us. Yeah. High five.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I've had such a good time. How can people follow you on social media to keep up with your stuff?
I am on Instagram, Nelson H. Lees, and that's it.
I love it. Keep it simple, man.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been so much fun having you here and talking and reconnecting.
Yeah, Jillian. Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks again to Nelson for coming on the show and spending some time with me. The world is far too small. My mom ended up looking at her Facebook messages, and she did have a Facebook message from Nelson from like 2010. So weird. Yeah, the world is too small, y'all. So yeah, check out Nelson's Instagram and all that stuff. If you haven't watched Last of Us Episode 8, I don't know what the heck you're waiting for. And I'm really excited to see what else he does in the future, because he's such a great actor and it was so fun talking to him. Tune in next week. I have Lynn Downey on the show. She is in the brand new series Daisy Jones and the Six. We talk all about how cool it was to create a world that big and that fun and that loved by so many. So tune in next week, and as always, thanks for coming in.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.